From the studios of Boise State Public Radio News, I'm Gemma Gaudet. You're listening to Idaho Matters. Former President Donald Trump is on trial, and he's facing several trials. He's also under a gag order, and there are attempts to keep him off the presidential ballot in some states. And also recently in the news is a law that disarms people who are under domestic violence orders. Dr. David Adler is the president of the Alturas Institute, and when he isn't studying the U.S. Constitution, he's watching the news and wondering about the current constitutional controversies that are dominating news programs all around our country. Dr. Adler is getting ready for another of his constitutional questions on Thursday at the Yonke Center in Boise. And this most recent one will be titled Constitutional Controversies in the News. And he's joining us with a preview. Dr. Adler, it's always nice to have you on the program.
Thank you for having me, Gemma. It's a pleasure to be with you again.
So let's start with former President Donald Trump. He's facing at least four trials, and there have been claims that he should be immune from prosecution. True or false on this?
He is certainly asserting that, and he, of course, is facing some 91 charges, a function of both federal and state charges, Gemma. The reality here is that the Trump legal team is asserting a legal claim called executive immunity, which would essentially prevent the president from being tried. And also he projects that as an ex-president, he should be immune from legal prosecution. And his claims have no leg to stand on, just to state it bluntly. There's nothing in the text of the Constitution, nothing in the history, nothing in Supreme Court precedents, and certainly nothing in the discussions by the delegates who wrote the Constitution in 1787 or in the state ratifying conventions for that matter, Gemma. Just no interest in granting to the president what would be a monarchical power. In England at that time, it was understood that, quote, the king could do no wrong. The king was above the law. But the framers of the Constitution were all about subordinating the president to the rule of law, making him amenable to the judicial process like all other citizens. So this is a cooked up argument without any historical precedent. And indeed, if he were to prevail on this claim, it would shred the very principle of the rule of law and hoist the president above the law, totally against the aims and purposes of those who wrote the Constitution and created the presidency.
So President Trump is also under a gag order, and this was put in place by a U.S. federal district judge. Is that a problem legally, since he is making another run for president right now? Because I'm curious about what are the free speech implications of the gag order?
Yeah, it's a fascinating question, Gemma. Of course, courts are reluctant to impose gag orders on candidates seeking high office, particularly the presidency, for fear that they'll be accused of engaging in judicial interference. But Judge Chutkan, the federal judge to whom you referred, has drawn a very narrow order, which does not undercut Trump's presidential candidacy, nor, importantly, does it undercut his First Amendment rights. Here's why. Under this narrowly tailored order, he is simply forbidden from attacking the court staff, the prosecutors or staff members of the prosecution, forbidden from attacking witnesses or attempting to engage in intimidation tactics that could influence the jurors and perhaps prevent those witnesses from doing their duty and telling the truth. So this is a narrowly tailored order, which would apply in any criminal case, by the way, Gemma. But the problem here, of course, is that Trump is asserting judicial interference. Even if we were to say that this had implications for his First Amendment rights as a matter of free speech, there would still be no basis for Trump's argument that this violates free speech. And here's why. The Supreme Court, for well over a century, ever since it began ruling on freedom of speech issues way back in 1919, has held that whatever the broad scope of free speech is, and it's very broad, it nonetheless is not broad enough to protect speech, which moves people to violence, which threatens violence or moves people to violence. And what has occurred here in the last few months and promoted the decision by Judge Chutkan to impose the gag order was that his threats were in fact leading to threats of violence against the court staff, against the prosecutor staff particularly, and certainly was targeting, and they certainly were targeting, the likely witnesses in his case, including former Vice President Pence and his former Chief of Staff, Mark Meadows, among others. Even if we were to say there's a free speech claim here, there's no protection for this speech, which is essentially promoting violence. And all of these people that I've just mentioned have had to hire or request additional security to guard them because of the death threats, for example, that were made against Judge Chutkan. So this is real life. This is very scary. And we want the integrity of the judicial process to be protected. And the judicial process can be quickly undermined if, in fact, defendants in criminal trials are able to threaten witnesses and threaten prosecutors and threaten judges. That is, after all, what we're familiar with in cases involving mafia figures. And that's why this gag order is narrowly tailored. Now, it should be said that Judge Chutkan, who was an utterly professional judge, imposed that order. When the Trump team challenged it, she paused it, reconsidered, and after careful reconsideration, re-implemented it. And then, of course, the Trump team applied to the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals, which has paused the gag order while it considers the merits of the order. I fully expect that the D.C. Circuit Court is going to uphold Judge Chutkan's gag order because it's meritorious, narrowly tailored, and there's nothing about Trump's candidacy for the presidency that is affected. If a candidacy for the presidency is grounded on threats to prosecutors and judges, then we're in a world of hurt. We're in big trouble if a candidate's speech promoting violence is protected by the Constitution.
And before we leave Trump, there are some states who are trying to keep the former president off the ballot for the 2024 presidential election. So, Dr. Adler, can they do that? Is this constitutional?
This is a fascinating question, isn't it? Lawsuits have been brought in a number of states, including Colorado, New Hampshire, Michigan, Minnesota, asserting that by virtue of Section 3 of the 14th Amendment, that former President Donald Trump is disqualified from running for president because it is said that he participated in and furthered the insurrection on January 6th. And Section 3 of the 14th Amendment, crafted by the very men who were in fact the men who wrote the 14th Amendment, were concerned to prevent Confederates from holding office because they engaged in the insurrection, made it possible to disqualify those men from being on the ballot. And so the effort is mounted here to prevent Trump having a spot on the ballot on the grounds that he was in violation of Section 3, which says that someone who's previously taken an oath to uphold the Constitution and then promoted or furthered or participated in or engaged in an insurrection or a rebellion is disqualified. So the legal issue here, then, there are several legal issues, Gemma, but The first of which is who gets to decide whether or not Trump can qualify for a ballot in any of these states where lawsuits have been brought. The Colorado judge has already decided that the lawsuit can go forward. In Minnesota, the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court wrote an opinion dismissing the lawsuit, saying that there's no state law to implement Section 3. And also the cases are pending in Michigan and New Hampshire. Now, this is a fascinating question with great implications for our electoral history, because if in fact various states were to render various rulings, creating kind of a hopscotch board, then that would cause a lot of chaos. And this is why, if in fact the judge does ultimately rule that the Secretary of State in Colorado, in charge of elections, can make the decision to bar Trump from the ballot in Colorado, then given that ruling and the case dismissing it in the decision dismissing the case in Minnesota, will have conflicting opinions. The Supreme Court will have to be involved to decide whether states have this authority. What's at issue, of course, is A, whether Trump was involved in promoting the insurrection. That's a case of great importance. B, who has the authority to bar a candidate from the ballot? And C, we should say, if and when such a case reaches the Supreme Court, how the Supreme Court might resolve this unprecedented case. Many who have followed this closely have noted that in Section 3 of the 14th Amendment, that the framers did not intend to limit this to the Civil War, because during the debate conducted by the 39th Congress, which wrote this 14th Amendment, the initial language provided that anybody who had participated in, quote, the late rebellion, referring to the Civil War, is maybe disqualified under this section. But a Congressman Edmondson substituted language which broadened it to any insurrection, thus indicating that the authors of the 14th Amendment were concerned not merely with the Civil War, but with all future insurrections. And so one of the key points to note here is that the issue is not a matter of criminal prosecution. So in deciding whether Trump is barred from serving, from appearing on a ballot under Section 3, we don't bring in the criminal law requirement of proof beyond a reasonable doubt. This is merely the question of whether a state official can bar Trump. It's a question of great moment, to be sure. And as I say, there will likely be different opinions delivered in different states, all of which, it seems to me, Gemma, means that such a case would move quickly to the Supreme Court. And when the Supreme Court wants to hear a case expeditiously, it can do it. The courts will simply give notice that the case should be expedited for review to the Supreme Court. This has happened historically in cases that listeners are probably familiar with: the Pentagon Papers case in 1972, the Steele seizure case in 1952. It's rare, but it can be done. And with the primaries only a couple of months away, this would have to be a case that the court would hear very quickly. But how the court would rule on such a case is not only a matter of great national moment, but it's a matter of great importance to the integrity of our constitutional system.
So I want to turn to the Second Amendment now, and a law that takes guns away from people under domestic violence orders. Can you start with the law and what it says?
Yeah, essentially it says that the federal law simply says that when state courts impose restraints on those who have been found guilty of domestic violence or who otherwise under orders by court because of their acts of domestic violence, that they're forbidden from gun possession. And this is very important given the horrifying and extremely high level of domestic violence that we experience here across America. And this case came out of Texas, a man named Rahimi, who is by all agreement a bad man, a drug dealer, owned a gun, assaulted his wife, and then went on a shooting spree in Arlington, Texas. And he's claiming that the imposition of the law to dispossess him of his firearm violates his Second Amendment right. So in this case that's now before the Supreme Court, just had oral argument the other day, the court is being asked whether or not the law can withstand challenge on the Second Amendment. The Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals, extremely conservative court, said it couldn't, that it violated the Second Amendment. And so this is a case of grave importance, not only to protect those who have been the victims of domestic violence or who might be. And while it doesn't appear that from the oral argument that was held that any of the justices were sympathetic to Rahimi, I think probably people recognize that he's a dangerous person. The question is, what's the standard for saying that somebody should be denied possession because they're a dangerous person? What are the elements of dangerousness, for example? And how far does the Second Amendment go to protect people who have committed acts of domestic violence? And can they retain possession of their firearms? That's a great question before the court. The real problem here, Gemma, is that after the Heller decision in 2008, when the Supreme Court for the very first time in our history held that there is an individual right to keep and bear arms, the court had never said that before. The court had always previously held that you enjoy a Second Amendment right only to own a gun to participate in the defense of the country. The court essentially created a right out of whole cloth. And so that was the first time then that there's an enforceable right to keep and bear arms. The Supreme Court made a mess of the Heller decision last term in a New York State Pistol and Rifle Association versus Bruin, when it said that the lower courts, in hearing cases involving challenges to state regulations, can only uphold a state law if that state can produce an analogous statute from, say, 1791, when the Bill of Rights was drafted. This was Clarence Thomas's opinion for a 6-3 majority in Bruin, arguing that, in fact, a current statute must have an analog to a statute in existence at the time that the Second Amendment was written. Setting aside for just a second all the difficulties that we face in applying that standard, it cannot have application in domestic violence cases because at that point in time, the U.S. law acted under the doctrine of coverture. Women did not have a legal status. They were considered essentially an appendage of their husband, gained rights by virtue of their marriage to a man. And B, there were no laws that prohibited domestic violence because at that point, sadly, women were considered objects. So if the standard today under the Bruin rule is to say that there has to be an analogous domestic violence law in 1791 that would disarm a perpetrator of a firearm, then it's going to be very difficult for the court to uphold the challenge to the Second Amendment. And so the court's going to have to return to what it was doing, I think, before Bruin, and that is allowing a balancing test, measuring the interest of the gun owner against the interest of public safety. The court, in Justice Thomas's opinion, wanted to erase the balancing test and insist on this adherence to old, outdated traditions, which no longer apply. And that would wreck our constitutional jurisprudence if in fact the court followed that doctrine with respect to all provisions of the Constitution. So I think the court is going to have to find a way to uphold the disposition of the ownership of guns in this case, perhaps without overturning Bruin, because the court will be reluctant to do that just a year after it rendered the decision, but perhaps guided by the arguments of Solicitor General Prolegar, find ways to say that lower courts have mischaracterized Bruin. That's a very clever, diplomatic, charitable approach for the Solicitor General, but she's very smart to do that rather than to ask the court to simply overturn Bruin, which it may have to do at some point, but not yet.
So before I let you go, Dr. Adler, is it frustrating for you as a constitutional scholar to watch the news and these constitutional controversies that come up on some of these programs? And I guess more importantly, how dangerous is it, in your opinion, for people who watch these programs to see information that may, you know, be false or misleading when it comes to the U.S. Constitution?
Yeah, I appreciate that question, Gemma. It's deeply disturbing. I think it induces insomnia. The problem here is that Americans who are interested in the Constitution, and many will say that they have profound respect for it, even revere it, will sometimes lack a good scope of knowledge to follow the government's actions or Supreme Court rulings, let alone being able to critique or criticize judicial opinions and interpretations by governmental officials. And so what we need is for the citizenry to have a broader base of knowledge about the Constitution. We have to avoid cherry picking, where governmental officials or citizens decide that they like one section of the Constitution and therefore want to go to the mat to defend it, but care little about another provision in the Constitution and don't care if that provision is trampled upon by governmental officials, because cherry picking will lead, unfortunately, to the conversion of the Constitution into Swiss cheese. It will be chock full of holes, and that leads to the likelihood that more and more people will simply decide which laws they'll abide by, and will lead to governmental officials ignoring the law when they don't like it. And that teaches the citizenry a very dangerous lesson, in my mind, Gemma, because as Justice Brandeis said for the court, the government is the best teacher. And if viewers or listeners, readers, see that governmental officials are engaged in cherry picking or delivering misleading information about the Constitution, then that really undercuts the prospects for our democracy to succeed. So I would hope that programs would be more rigorous, would try like the Dickens to avoid promoting misleading information, and that American citizens would have their antenna up so that they are not misled by false reports or demagoguery. And if an ex-president like Donald Trump can make arguments which are grossly exaggerative of the law and the Constitution, and his followers believe him, that has dangerous implications for their respect of the rule of law. Because if they believe falsely, for example, that the 2020 election was fabricated, that it was rigged, and that it was fraudulent, and that Donald Trump really won the election, then that not only undercuts their respect for the rule of law, but for our entire democracy and the institutions of government, on which our democracy rests. So, as we often say, and this is certainly true in your profession, the truth must prevail. Facts and truth must prevail. And that's so important in a democracy, particularly one created by the founders who were children of the Enlightenment and believe that discussion had to be guided by facts and truth and evidence. Those are the keys to securing a bright future for the democracy. Disinformation, exaggeration, false reports are the clear way to undercut our democracy.
Well, as always, Dr. Adler, appreciate you coming on the program and talking to us more about this. We've been speaking with Dr. David Adler, the president of the Alturas Institute, about his upcoming constitutional conversation on controversies in the news. It will happen this Thursday at the Yonkey Center in Boise. Thanks again, Dr. Adler.
Thank you very much for having me, Gemma.
Thanks so much for listening to Idaho Matters. Boise State Public Radio and Idaho Matters are members of the NPR Network. It's an independent coalition of public media podcasters. You can find more shows in the network wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Gemma Gaudette. We'll see you tomorrow.
This is my voice. It can tell you a lot about me, and I'm not changing it for anyone. In NPR's Black Stories, Black Truths, you'll find a collection of NPR episodes centered on the Black experience. Search NPR Black Stories, Black Truths wherever you get podcasts.